Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up today, world leaders meet at the UN and in a U.S. state in high-level summits aimed at combating climate change. What one aid agency wants to see come out of the meetings, and what another fears could happen if we fail to act now. And hope for peace in the Middle East. Is there any left? One journalist covering the Israeli-Palestinian conflict gives us some insight. Climate change, the focus of high-level international meetings in the U.S. this week. Heads of state and government meeting at the UN headquarters in New York were to receive some sobering words from Secretary General Ban Ki-moon about the effects of global warming on the planet. Tuesday's one-day summit has been seen as a much-needed injection in the arm to get governments jumping to overcome outstanding obstacles that have prevented official talks on climate change from moving forward. G20 leaders of the world's biggest industrialized and developing nations are scheduled later this week in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, to discuss how industrial nations can help poorer countries meet the climate change challenge. Well, Emer McCarthy spoke to Robert Bailey, senior policy advisor to the international aid organization Oxfam, about this week's U.S. summits. She began by asking him why wealthy nations should lend a hand to developing countries.
There are two things that we need to see funding for in developing countries as a result of climate change. The first is for adaptation, for helping the most vulnerable countries, the most vulnerable communities, the most vulnerable households adapt to climate change. And the reason that we need to see this money coming from rich countries to poor countries is that it's because rich countries are the ones that have created climate change through their historic emissions over the last century, through industrialization, through burning fossil fuels. They have created the cumulative emissions in the atmosphere that are causing the current climate change that we're now experiencing. It's also because not only are they the most responsible, but they're also the most capable of helping. Because through the process of industrialization, through the process of creating these emissions, through the process of causing climate change, of course, industrialized countries became rich. So they have an obligation through their responsibility and through their economic capability to help the most vulnerable countries. The other thing, the other reason that we need to see money going from rich countries to poor countries to tackle climate change is simply because we're not going to avoid catastrophic climate change if we only see emission savings in the rich world. We're also going to need to see significant emissions avoided in emerging economies, particularly economies such as China, India, Brazil, other developing economies. And the only way that these poor countries can afford to make these emission savings is with financial help from rich countries, those that have created the problem of climate change in the first place.
Now, I believe it was over a week ago that Oxfam presented the findings of an EU Commission report before it was published. They were quite shocking to the scientific community and indeed to many aid organizations who have been campaigning for increased funding to tackle the effects of climate change in developing countries, because the funding that the EU Commission suggests to the European member states falls far short of the target that that many experts believe is necessary. Would you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, well, Oxfam has estimated that about $150 billion a year of new and additional public finance is necessary to help poor countries adapt to climate change and move on to low-carbon paths of development. And what was proposed in the Commission document was something in the region of about $20 to $50 billion a year. So it falls far, far short of what Oxfam thinks is required and what a lot of other scientists and development agencies would say is required as well. So that would mean two things. First of all, it means there won't be enough money going to developing countries to help them cut their own emissions and so to avoid catastrophic climate change. It also means that there won't be enough money going to developing countries to help them adapt to the climate change, which is not avoided. And of course, that will mean lives lost. It will mean livelihoods lost. It will mean rising sea levels and people unable to cope with them. It will mean disaster for literally millions and millions of poor people's lives.
The warming of the planet and subsequent rise of the oceans spell disaster for millions of people in low-lying coastal areas and islands. Flooding from excessive rainfall is expected to sweep many families' homes away. Drought in other parts of the developing world will mean no food, no water for countless others. Agencies like Oxfam say it's time to take action now before the problem gets worse.
What we need to see coming out of the G20 in Pittsburgh is a commitment from the international community to finance adaptation at a scale that is adequate and commensurate with the task at hand. There needs to be a political commitment from industrialized country leaders to set up a new international adaptation fund, which would raise about $50 billion a year in the first instance and distribute it to the poorest countries to help them adapt to climate change.
Robert Bailey is Senior Policy Advisor for the international aid agency, Oxfam. As world leaders talk shop in Pittsburgh, families in developing nations and those that stand to lose the most from climate change are weighing their options. Some will opt to stay home and confront the risks with the help of world governments or without them. Others will take their future into their own hands and abandon one sinking ship for another full of hope, immigration to a wealthier land. I asked the head of policy at the Geneva-based International Catholic Migration Commission, John Bingham, what happens later if we don't get climate change and migration right and now.
We have to get it right, you know, every day and month and not just all at once. It's migration is, you know, and human mobility has been with us since the beginning of time. It's one of the great builders of human civilization, of the very societies now that sometimes struggle with newcomers, are fundamentally migrant built. So we have to get it right. Every step of the way, we have to adjust to realities. Climate change is certainly a set of worries. Only one of which is the question of migrants that are losing their places of birth and losing their countries with no option but to migrate. That's a phenomenon that has to be addressed. Yes, and the world has come together and is coming together to try and consider the migration aspects of climate change along with the myriad of other concerns there. The idea of responding to migration or the need to respond to migration is not just one to imagine we can close doors and it'll be over. That would hurt the countries that need migrants as much as it would hurt the individual migrants and the families themselves. The challenge of the day and the challenge each day and moment in this, whether it's reacting to climate change possibilities or wars or conflicts or natural problem of famine or other, is to manage the migration. And that calls for bringing together all of the actors, the political actors at national and regional levels, the international institutions of the United Nations, among others, civil society organizations with the church always active on these issues, and other organizations, with the media, the role of the media increasingly important as a major actor and driver of action and reaction on these matters.
We haven't mentioned Pope Benedict and the Church's calls for integrating migrant communities into our societies.
Yes.
Is enough emphasis being placed on integrating migrants today?
Yeah, integration is one of the most important challenges facing societies and migrants alike. Migrants move to a country to either live there for a long period of time or sometimes just to work with shorter projects in mind. But the question of integration is itself, it's a challenge day to day. It's how a migrant lives in a society and is perceived in a society. It's how a society welcomes or not that migrant, and how together they hold together with some kind of social cohesion. The Church, always talks of common good. So as much as some think that the Church is only on the side of migrants or blindly on the side of migrants and foreigners, that's not where the Church stands. That's not where the Church hopes the situation will move, and that's not where we pray. Where we stand and hope and pray is for a sense of common good in neighborhoods, in cities, and in countries, and then a universal common good among nations and across the globe, where we can look at the needs of a society that's receiving migrants and the needs of migrants, all as human reflections of God, and say, how do we make this thing work? Integration is a key, is a key to a sense of belonging, a sense of solidarity, and the achievement of a common good.
And a warm thanks there to John Bingham, who is head of policy at the Geneva-based International Catholic Migration Commission. Go over to the Middle East, which has been racked by decades of conflict. Perhaps the one conflict that has defined the rest, the ongoing violence and hatred between Israelis and Palestinians. I often wonder what it must be like for a local journalist in the Holy Land to cover the suicide bombings, the Israeli airstrikes, the occupation. Of that horrible conflict, Pope John Paul II often said, "There can be no peace without justice, and no justice without forgiveness." To this day, the injustices painfully remain. Peace and forgiveness seem unattainable dreams. So, I can't help but ask, what has happened to the hope? Is there any left for Palestinians and Israelis? I put that question to visiting freelance journalist Lamia Lahoud, who lives and works in the Holy Land. Let's listen. You've seen horrific times and hopeful times. What are some of the moments that will always remain most with you?
When Yitzhak Rabin and King Hussein of Jordan sat together in the desert, and they both looked so happy, and they actually looked like they liked each other, and there was like a feeling of hope, and people were mingling, and everybody was like very happy and trying to get a picture opportunity, with somebody from the Arab side and some of the Arabs from people from the Jewish side. And you really had the feeling that things are going to change, that there was a big wave of change. And the same was really true in Taba when they had the negotiations in the very beginning for the Gaza-Jericho Accord. That was before the actual peace agreement. And there was like this feeling of, people were getting to know each other and they were actually forming relationships. So they would sit down, have lunch together, and they would like each other on an individual basis. And that was very, very hopeful because they started to understand each other. And at Camp David, things went a little bit wrong, although there the atmosphere was between some people very good, between others very bad. But then there was like this big blow up afterwards, which kind of destroyed everybody's hopes, because before that there was a lot of hope, and people were looking at a new future, making plans. I mean, there were businessmen from both sides, Jordan, Palestinians, Israelis, who were having joint business ventures ideas and companies who wanted to work together, and, you know, tourist ideas, and then it just all fell apart.
It all fell apart in a series of failures by the two sides to find a minimum of common ground. The Camp David meeting in July 2000 ended in stalemate, and the Taba-Egypt talks failed after Ariel Sharon, an adversary of Israeli concessions in Oslo and Camp David, was elected as Israeli premier 2 weeks later in February 2001. Lamia remembers hopes for peace soared after the 1993 Oslo Accords and the historic handshake between Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat and Israeli Premier Yitzhak Rabin at the White House. Just a few months later, on August 8, 1994, Rabin met Jordan's King Hussein to confirm peace with Israel's Arab neighbor and inaugurate the Aqaba-Eilat border crossing. But the protagonists of those dreams for peace now long gone, few leaders have since found the courage to follow in their footsteps. One of the tragic problems, Lamia explains, has been the failure to get the support of average Palestinians and Israelis for peace.
So many years of suffering on both sides, so much brainwashing also that you can't just erase from one day to the other. Whole generations that were brought up to believe different things, and suddenly they see their leaders sitting together, talking together, you know, talking about peace, and they're asked to make concessions that they were told are impossible, they could never make. So I think it never really went down to the masses. And I kind of agree with the present president of Israel, Shimon Peres, that if there would have been more involvement, you know, like trying to put money in and trying to give more opportunity and trying to reach the people on the ground on both sides, and especially on the Palestinian side, because they really did have a much harder economic situation and they were living in misery in many areas, maybe then there would have been much more response to, you know, to these ideas, which for many were very strange, because it was the rich and the powerful and the people in politics who were all chatting and sitting together yesterday, enemies, today friends. People on the lower level didn't really get it. So I don't think it was the leadership then. Today, people are tired. People want peace. They're really worn out. Especially on the Israeli side, on the Palestinian side, if you live under constant attack, I think you don't know anymore how to live any different. I mean, you dream of a different life. In Ramallah, for example, people are very hopeful that there will be a peace process because they don't live under constant attack. But if you live in Gaza and you're constantly under attack, you don't really know anymore how to live any different way. So maybe there it's not like that. But in Ramallah, in some of the West Bank cities, in Bethlehem, definitely, and in Israel, people are tired and they just want to finish it and, you know, and move on with their lives. But they have leaderships that are not ready to do that.
You said people dream about a better future, but have they lost hope in that better future?
Yes. I think that nobody really believes it anymore. Or maybe they kind of hope that they can believe it, but they don't want to admit to themselves that they believe it because they don't want to be disappointed again. So they have like all this negative attitude on both sides. Oh, it's never going to work. Oh, it's never going to work. And I think that's one of the problems. That's why leaderships are being elected that are not going to move forward towards, you know, changing things or towards change. And I think this is really what happened in Israel, because I don't think that the population doesn't want to move forward. And I think maybe they're more ready today to make certain concessions than during Camp David. But they have lost hope and they're like, oh, it's not going to work. So a very right-wing government managed to take over, even at the cost of being in conflict with the American government today. So I think this is kind of what motivated them. On the Palestinian side, they throw their hands in the air. Oh, there's nothing we can do. It's either Israel or Hamas or this or that. Nothing is going to change. You know, it's going to go on and on and on. So there's a hopelessness, but there's a little, you know, like this little side inside, this little voice inside that says, well, maybe there's a little bit of hope. And that should be taken to move forward on, I think.
Now, Israel recently has come under fire for displacing Palestinians in East Jerusalem and putting Jewish families in Palestinian homes. They've received criticism from the European Union, also from the United States. And there's more pressure on Israel at this moment to really take the initiative in working out a peace plan, or at least jump-starting that process again. What do the people on the grassroots feel about this? Are the Israelis in accordance with their government's policy?
Yes, not all the Israelis, obviously, but many in Israel, because first of all, there was a campaign that was very anti-Barack Obama. He was being represented as a Muslim in the campaign, as somebody who was very much in favor of Muslim states. And I personally was very upset at that. But it kind of sunk in. And then when America criticizes Israel, Israelis kind of joined together, even those who don't agree, and say, no, they can't, you know, tell us what to do. We are the ones living in this situation, whatever. And thinks it's not a government that they believe has a lot of experience. So that also helps get the consensus. Now, the settlement issue is an issue that I think most Israelis agree that the settlements, especially the illegal outposts, should be evacuated. And I don't think there's a controversy over it. The problem is that if Bibi Netanyahu does that, which he has to do, then he will have to do something to put his own coalition partners at ease from the right-wing, you know, parties, because that's what gave him his strength. And he will have to do something in Jerusalem, like, for example, remove Palestinians who have built what is illegal housing, like we're living in buildings that are not built by Israeli standards, who don't have building permits by, you know, by Israeli law. So that he can say, okay, I'm doing it there. I am extending Jerusalem. I am going to secure Jerusalem. I'm never going to compromise on Jerusalem, without actually saying it, but he's showing it. But at the same time, I have to remove you guys because you're also living in houses and in areas that are illegal. We never gave you permit to live there. So I think this is what he's trying to do politically, really. And it kind of passes in Israel. Of course, you have, like, the Labour Party and the left that is against it and is protesting. But the population in general kind of goes along with it, yes.
Because you do have groups like the Israeli Committee for Against House Demolitions and so on, which are human rights organizations which work to support the Palestinian families who are being evicted from their homes and their homes are being bulldozed, or these, for example, these families in East Jerusalem which are being forced to leave. They are the first to point out that the Israeli government very often makes it difficult for Palestinian families to receive the correct permits for house building, or that it could take up to years and years in order to obtain the permits. But this is not an issue that is arriving down, again, at the grassroots level.
No, it did at one point. I mean, there was when the Labour Party took power, a lot of people talked about that, and people wanted to change that, obviously, also. And there are groups that are very, very active and are doing really a lot. I mean, there are also lawyers who are trying to represent these people. And yes, there was a policy in Jerusalem not to give building permits to Palestinians, especially in certain areas. And there has been a lot written in the Israeli press about it. But I think the grassroots doesn't go into that detail. They see Hamas is in power, Islamic fundamentalists there. They don't want peace with us. That's what the Israeli, I'm talking now really the basic, you know, the grassroots, the public on the ground thing. And, okay, we have to remove the settlers. They're just a nuisance to us also. But, you know, if we remove them, so it's okay to remove the Palestinians from their illegal houses. And why should they have something in Jerusalem if they don't want to make peace? This is the reasoning. I mean, it might sound for an outsider absurd, whatever, but it's on both sides very similar. Both grassroots think very much along the same lines.
You've been living in the region for so many years, and you've been witness firsthand to this conflict. Is it ever difficult for you to remain impartial when reporting?
Yes, but it also changes, like, on what side of the divide you are. Like, let's say when you're sitting in Gaza and you see a bomb fall on a building where there are, you know, civilians in the building and 14 children get killed, you want to cry and your heart breaks. Then when you stand in front of the Dolphinarium and you see, you know, a young man blow himself up, killing all these young, beautiful, you know, boys and girls that are going out to have a good time, then you get angry and your heart breaks there. So in these moments, of course, you're torn and it's very, very difficult. But I think not really, because the thing is, there has to be some kind of justice. Okay, we know the realities on the ground. They will not be changed. And, I mean, everybody has their personal feeling about that. But you have to work with those realities and try to make the best that creates a human just situation for both sides, a situation in which both people can actually make a better life, have a future, and that's the only way that they will ever achieve peace, and to get rid of all kinds of hatred, radicalism, fanaticism, you know, fundamentalism, whatever, to rid yourself of these things and move forward. And I think that it's not so difficult, because one thing that is very, very special, especially when you're reporting in Israel, is that in all the trouble, you always find these amazing stories of courage, you know, of people that just go against the flow and take personal risks and stand up for what they believe. You know, mothers whose sons have been killed by Palestinians go and stand at the checkpoints to make sure that the soldiers don't mistreat, you know, Palestinians who are passing the checkpoints and things like that. I mean, they're just unbelievable. Or the mother of a Palestinian child who received an Israeli heart or vice versa. They meet, they sit, they you know, they hug each other, they bond suddenly. And then you have doctors that go to the Palestinian areas, bring the children over together with Palestinian doctors and they give them surgery. You know, you have a lot of courage, things that are happening on both sides that really gives you the feeling that, yes, the situation is kind of deadlocked, but it's, if you look at history, it's always been a difficult place. But it's also a place that has a lot of hope and a lot of potential, and there are a lot of beautiful stories in the tragedy and that show you that there's a possibility to really have some kind of humanity and justice for both people.
Do you think that the local media and the international media effectively portray these hopeful, these good stories out of the region?
No, but that's, I personally have been very, very frustrated by that, because it's always the catastrophes that attract attention rather than the positive stories. Although lately, I think on the Israeli side, the public is also so tired of the news that goes around and around and the same, that there have been like positive stories also that have been covered. But the international media, I think, has been very reluctant to do so. Every once in a while a feature story, but not much. And it's sad, because really the image that you get, I mean, you call somebody, I have friends in Brazil, I talk to them and I ask them, oh, let's meet, why don't you come over? No, you're living at war, bombs are exploding everywhere, it's dangerous. You know, you get this impression that people are living under, they do, but they still exist and still have a normal life. To some extent, not everywhere. In Gaza, for example, there's no normal life. You know, there are days of normal life and other days that are totally abnormal. But in the West Bank, in Ramallah, and in Israel, there is, despite everything, a normal life. And there are people who try to make things better, to try to make a change. And I think that if you would focus more on these stories, I think more people would be interested in also investing in people who are doing something about it on a private level, not on a political level. You know, for example, doctors who need also financing to help people from both sides, to put money in, to put attention to. And then maybe you could really get much more of that personal contact that you met in Taba when the two sides met on the political level, and they get to know each other on a different level and can work things out. And it might be a long process, and I'm sure it won't be resolved overnight, but there is hope.
And a warm thanks there to Lamia Lahoud, a freelance journalist based in the Holy Land. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. If you'd like to hear this and other programs on our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Again, thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.